Well, Christmas is coming. Aren't we looking forward to it? Hands up if you're looking forward to Christmas. There's a mixture, isn't there? There's a mixture. I wonder if we went out on the streets and took a poll, what sort of answers we'd get. I'm sure there'd be some who'd really be looking forward to Christmas. Maybe children looking forward to presents, time off school. Many looking forward to times with meeting up with family and friends. But I suspect there would be many who would not be. Many with anxieties over all the busy arrangements. Mainly the female of the species, I suspect. Many would not be looking forward to it because it would be a painful reminder of loved ones who won't be around, or of broken relationships and broken families. And if we'd have done a similar survey 2,000 years ago, or 2,021 years ago, in Palestine, and asked who was looking forward to a birth of the Messiah, I think we'd also have got a very mixed response. There were some looking forward to it, but most weren't, I think. And it wouldn't have been uniform. There were groups of people. There were the Sadducees, who were collaborating with the Roman occupiers and doing very well, thank you. I don't think they were looking forward to it. There were the Pharisees, who were convinced that God wouldn't do anything until the people turned back to the law and strictly obeyed the law. But they'd become very self-centered and they'd really lost the plot. There were the Zealots, who were looking to get rid of the Romans by an armed insurrection. There were sects like the Essenes, who thought it was all too difficult and had gone off and set up their communes in the desert. So all sorts of different types. And true, there were some who were looking forward to the birth of a Messiah. We meet a couple of them in Luke's Gospel, don't we? Anna and Simeon. But even those who were expecting a Messiah were generally thinking of some military or political leader who would deliver the people from the Romans. They weren't looking for a poor carpenter who would die on a cross. And there were clues, there were pointers in their scriptures, but frankly they weren't obvious. In fact, even those who had spent a lot of time with Jesus, his closest disciples, had not really understood these clues. We read this in Luke's Gospel after the resurrection. He said to them, that's Jesus said to them, this is what I told you while I was still with you. Everything must be fulfilled that is written about me in the law of Moses, the prophets, and the Psalms. Then he opened their minds so they could understand the scriptures. He told them, this is what is written. The Messiah will suffer and rise from the dead on the third day, and repentance for the forgiveness of sins will be preached in his name to all nations, beginning at Jerusalem. You are witnesses of these things. And by studying the scriptures, the Old Testament, they and the early church saw and understood these pointers to Jesus. But it was a slow process. It took Jesus 40 days after the resurrection to be teaching them the scriptures. And in this time leading up to Christmas, this Advent time, at Christ Church Hill, we're going to be looking at some of these pointers to Jesus in three of the great characters of the Old Testament. This morning in Abraham, then next week in Moses, and the week after in Solomon. And this week we're going to think a little about Abraham. We're going to get to Abraham, but first I want to take us back to the very beginning of God's relationship with humanity, to the story of Adam and Eve in the Garden of Eden. We read in Genesis chapter 1 how God created the world, and the pinnacle of his creation, if you like, was to create man and woman in his image. And they were given a task. God said to them, be fruitful and increase in number, fill the earth and subdue it, rule over the fish in the sea and the birds in the sky and over every living creature that moves on the ground. Men and women were given a task. They were to be God's helpers, God's agents, ruling over his creation on his behalf. And what were they going to need to do that? They were going to need to be able to distinguish between good and bad, between right and wrong. If we read, which we haven't got time to do this morning, if we read the story of creation in Genesis chapter 1, we get this repeated phrase, don't we? And God saw that it was good. There's an implicit distinction between God doing good and doing what is bad and what is evil. And how were men and women to get this wisdom, to get this ability to choose between good and bad so that they could rule over his creation? They were to seek God for his wisdom, to learn from him the difference between good and evil, between right and wrong. They were not to acquire this knowledge in their own strength, not to do what appeared good in their own eyes. So as Karina read to us, the Lord God commanded the man, "You are free to eat from any tree in the garden, but you must not eat from the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. For when you eat from it, you will certainly die." Their wisdom, their knowledge of good and evil, was to be learned from God. They were not to seek this wisdom independently of God. And what happened? Well, we know the story, and Karina's read it again to us this morning. They were tempted by the serpent, and both ate from the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. And that ruined their relationship with God. It ruined their relationship with each other. And it ruined, in a sense, their relationship with themselves, their own self-consciousness. They were now ashamed and afraid. And when God seeks to talk to them, to impart his wisdom, when he comes walking in the garden in the cool of the day, in the cool of the evening, they hide from him and they won't listen to his voice. So God said to Adam, then to Adam he said, "Because you have listened to the voice of your wife and have eaten from the tree about which I commanded you, saying, 'You shall not eat from it,' cursed is the ground because of you." Relationships have been ruined, and in a sense, the rest of the Bible is all about the restoration of those relationships. And one of the key figures in that restoration is Abraham. Now, I'm not going to attempt this morning to tell the whole story of Abraham. You'll be glad to know. But if you know something of the Bible, you'll know that God called Abraham and his household out of the place they were living and makes a promise to him, a promise which actually is in the form, in the Hebrew, of a seven-line poem, which is surely supposed to remind us of the 7 days of creation. And so he says to Abraham, "I will make you into a great nation and I will bless you. I will make your name great and you will be a blessing. I will bless those who bless you, and whoever curses you, I will curse. And all peoples on earth will be blessed through you." So Abraham obeyed God and he left his hometown. But if you know the story, you'll know that there was a big problem. God had promised to make him a great nation, but children hadn't come. And Abraham and his Sarah were getting to an age where children weren't likely to come. What should they do? They needed wisdom. They needed to be able to choose between good and bad, between right and wrong. But instead of seeking God, they came up with their own plan. And to get a full understanding of this passage, we'd need to look at it in the original language, but I'm afraid my grasp of Hebrew isn't nearly good enough to do that. So I'm going to revert to a different translation of the Bible. It's the New American Standard Bible, and it's a more literal translation than the normal translations that we use. And we read in that translation, "Now Sarah, Abraham's wife, had not borne him a child, but she had an Egyptian slave woman whose name was Hagar. So Sarai said to Abraham, 'See now, the Lord has prevented me from bearing children. Please have relations with my slave woman. Perhaps I will obtain children through her.' And Abraham listened to the voice of Sarah. And so after Abraham had lived 10 years in the land of Canaan, Abraham's wife Sarai took Hagar, the Egyptian, her slave woman, and gave her to her husband Abraham as his wife. Then he had relations with her, with Hagar, and she conceived." Now, in recounting this event, the writer has deliberately used some of the wording of the story of the fall in Genesis 3. So if you compare the two, you see Sarai took Hagar and she gave her to her husband. just as Eve took the fruit and gave it to her husband. And we get the phrase that Abraham listened to the voice of Sarai, just as God had said to Adam, because you have listened to the voice of your wife. Now that's a very unusual phrase in the Hebrew Bible, as it is in English. I might say that I've listened to what thou said. Sometimes that might be true. But I wouldn't say I've listened to her voice. But there's a deliberate parallel between the two. God, the writer, is deliberately linking back this story of Hagar to the story of Genesis 3 and saying, look, this is a replay of the fall. This is man and woman doing what is wise in their own eyes rather than trusting in God. This is man and woman, in a sense, eating from the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, seeking their own wisdom rather than seeking wisdom from God. Someone doing what we would probably have done, to be honest. And if we know the story of the Old Testament, we know that the consequences of Abraham and Sarah's decision were severe and they were long-reaching. They caused misery both in the short term and for generations to come. And I think that illustrates a fundamental problem, doesn't it? That is the root cause of much of the pain and grief we see around us in the world. We do what is right in our own eyes, rather than seeking the wisdom that comes from God. We make decisions in our own wisdom without seeking God's wisdom. We take the fruit from the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, and the consequences are always harmful. And they affect not just us, but our children and our children's children. Let's look briefly at one of the stories that Jesus told in response to someone who came and asked him about wisdom, really. They didn't use that word. But he came and asked him about how he should behave in a particularly financial situation, how he should behave in financial and family affairs, how he should choose between good and bad, right and wrong. Familiar story. Then Jesus said to them, watch out, be on your guard against all kinds of greed. Life does not consist in an abundance of possessions. That's a good message leading up to Christmas. And he told them this parable. The ground of a certain rich man yielded an abundant harvest. He thought to himself, what shall I do? I've no place to store my crops. Then he said, this is what I'll do. I'll tear down my barns and build bigger ones, and there I'll store my surplus grain. And I'll say to myself, you have plenty of grain laid up for many years. Take life easy, eat, drink, and be merry. I'm sure my financial advisor would endorse that. It all sounds very sensible, doesn't it? I could look at the financial section of today's Sunday papers and get much the same advice. But it leaves God out. It's doing what is wise in our own eyes rather than seeking God's wisdom. So if you remember the parable, Jesus goes on. But God said to him, you fool, this very night your life will be demanded from you. Then who will get what you have prepared for yourself? This is how it will be with whoever stores up things for themselves, but is not rich towards God. Jesus' verdict is that it's not sensible. It's foolishness. It's leaving God out of the equation. And our relationship with God is more important than all our possessions, all our time, even all of our human relationships. It's man's wisdom, and it's not God's wisdom. It's doing what is right in our own eyes rather than God's eyes. And as we look around the world this Christmas time, we see the consequences of doing what is right in our own eyes rather than looking to God for wisdom. We see the injustice and the conflict and the greed and the selfishness and the unfaithfulness and unkindness, don't we? We see it at a national and an international level, but I think we also see it at a personal level, in our own families, relationships and in our own selves. And we're left longing for the ability to know the wisdom that comes from God and the ability to follow his way of wisdom. We're going to look back briefly at the story of Abraham, because it's not all a disaster. Simon reminded us earlier that we read that God trusted in God and his faith was credited to him as righteousness. It's not all a disaster. God grants Abraham and Sarah a son, Isaac, despite their great age. And that's great news. It's the start of building this great nation that God had promised. But then, God puts Abraham to the test and says to him, I want you to take this son and I want you to sacrifice him to me. Surely that's not a wise thing to do. They've managed to conceive once in their old age, but now they're even older. Surely it's unlikely to happen again. What's Abraham going to do this time? Will he do what's right in his own eyes, or will he listen to God and follow God's wisdom? Well, we can read the story in Genesis chapter 2, and we're not going to do this morning for time's sake, but Abraham demonstrates that he is willing to obey God, to look to God for wisdom. He passes the test, if you like, and at the last minute, God provides an alternative and preserves Isaac. And then God speaks to Abraham and renews the covenant promise. So we read at the end of Genesis chapter 22. Then the angel of the Lord called to Abraham a second time from heaven and said, by myself I have sworn, declares the Lord, because you have done this thing and have not withheld your son, your only son, indeed I will greatly bless you, and I will greatly multiply your seed as the stars of the heavens, and as the sand which is on the seashore. And your seed shall possess the gate of their enemies, and in your seed all the nations of the earth shall be blessed, because you have obeyed my voice. Most translations use the word obeyed, but the Hebrew actually is listened to. The same phrase as we saw back in Genesis chapter 3 and Genesis chapter 16. God says, because you have listened to my voice rather than listening to your own voice or the voice of others, because you've listened to my voice, then I will bless you. And through your seed, through your offspring, all the nations of the earth will be blessed. So at the end of Abraham's life, we're left, in a sense, waiting, hoping, longing for a seed of Abraham, someone who will listen to God's voice. Not like Abraham, not just occasionally, but consistently, all the time. Someone who's going to bring a blessing to the nation. Someone who's going to look to God for wisdom. Someone who's not going to make themselves equal to, or try to make themselves equal to God, but to be prepared to follow God's way. Someone who would always listen to the voice of God. Someone who in Paul's words did not consider equality with God something to be used to his own advantage. Rather, he made himself nothing by taking the very nature of a servant, being made in human likeness, being found in appearance as a man, he humbled himself by becoming obedient to death, even death on a cross. We're left waiting and hoping and longing for Jesus in the opening verse of the New Testament. Jesus, the Messiah, the Son of David, the Son of Abraham. Jesus, the one who was always looking to his heavenly Father for wisdom, and the one who can help us to do the same. We're looking forward to Christmas, looking forward to another season when we can celebrate that God has stepped into our world and showed us the way of wisdom and invites us to follow it and gives us the grace to do so. Someone who will pay the price for all our foolishness and disobedience, all our seeking after our own wisdom. Someone who will redeem us from the penalty and power of that foolishness, the penalty and power of our sin. We're looking for Jesus. We're looking for Emmanuel, God with us. So let's celebrate the good news of Christmas. I think we can all look forward to that part of Christmas, even if we can't look forward to the celebrations and the family things and all the hassle of it. We can look forward to the reminder that God has provided his wisdom to us.